Hi, it's Patrick Cox here. My father is Irish, and when he was young, he took part in a great social experiment. It wasn't conceived as an experiment, but that's what it was. It was this: to learn Irish, a language that had been slowly dying out for centuries. All of a sudden, though, it was back in the schools. And like it or not, my dad studied it for a very long time.
I was learning Irish from when I was about five and a half until I left school, taught by the nuns.
This was in the 1930s and 40s, not long after Ireland won its independence.
So Ireland was a new country at the time.
It was.
And learning the language was presumably seen as an act of patriotism.
Learning the language was very important because being a new country, the idea was to have a language to go with it, but the language had always been there. And it was just a pity that it got stamped out so much, because it was one of the things which the penal laws, and indeed any laws brought in by the English, they took a very poor view of people speaking Irish.
The penal laws were a kind of anti-Catholic apartheid dating back to the 17th century. Irish Catholics spoke Irish, so use of the language was discouraged. Irish had been on the slide ever since. But now, in the 1930s, just a decade after independence from the Brits, the Irish language was back, in schoolrooms at least. The question was, would people speak it? That's actually still the question today. Another question too: why do so many Irish people resent having to learn it?
There's an enormous psychological resistance to learning the language, because the old symbolic weight of the language was still there. It was associated with poverty, with backwardness, with anti-modern attitude, anti-progress attitude. The psychological effort needed to overcome that symbolism, most people are not able or willing to make.
Today on the podcast, Irish language revitalization. The Irish have been at it for far longer than most revitalization efforts.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.
A bit of history first. Irish is a Celtic language. It came from somewhere in Europe. The Romans came across some of these Celtic languages in somewhat earlier form when they arrived in what is today Germany, Austria, Belgium, northern Spain, and elsewhere. We're talking about the 4th to 5th centuries BC.
We don't know exactly when those languages came first to Britain and then to Ireland, but they were certainly well established before the Christian era.
This is Jim McCloskey. Jim was born in Ireland. He now teaches at the University of California at Santa Cruz.
So a lot of the literary traditions and story traditions that you can hear even today as folk tales have their origins in pre-Roman Gaul, pre-Roman Austria, and so on. And by mechanism we don't now fully understand, at the point when Christianity came in around the 4th, 5th century AD, some remarkable coming together of sort of classical learning and local learning produced a very standardized literary language, what we now call Old Irish.
Which made it one of the oldest literary languages in Europe, older than English. This was a golden age for Irish, and it pretty much stayed that way for centuries as the language evolved from Old Irish to Middle Irish to Modern Irish. There were invasions by the Normans and then the English, and over time, other languages, French and then English, established themselves in towns on the coast, port towns like Dublin. But until the English really put their foot down, Irish was predominant.
Until about 1620, 1630, Ireland was basically a monolingual country whose only language was Irish. And it was only really with the expansion of English administrative power beyond the Pale, beyond Dublin, that that situation changes. So the crucial moment, the crucial initial moment in the decline of the language comes in the first half of the 17th century, not until then.
Oh, you mentioned beyond the Pale. I tried that out on a couple of Americans and asked them if they knew where that expression came from.
That's where it comes from.
That's where it comes from.
Yeah, the Pale was an imaginary fence around Dublin that kept the wild Irish at bay, and civilization, and English-speaking civilization, was safe inside the Pale in the capital city.
Yeah, I mean, you say the wild Irish. Was the language associated with this sort of wildness that increasingly, if from English eyes, needed to be tamed?
Absolutely.
Ah, the wild Irish and the civilized English. That myth has deep roots. And the trouble for the language was, it got caught up in that. You might even say it's still caught up in that, north of the border in Northern Ireland, which is still, of course, part of Britain. But the decline of Irish isn't just down to the Brits. Sure, they set it in motion, but later on, they got a big helping hand from a homegrown group.
The last steps in the elimination of Irish as a broadly spoken language, they were taken by a cooperative and collaborative effort between the colonial government in Dublin and the Catholic Church, the single two most powerful institutions that shaped the life of Ireland in the 19th century.
Yep, the Catholic Church, the very organization that centuries before had been the target of Britain's penal laws. Well, the Catholic Church survived, but over time it came to an understanding with Ireland's British rulers. The church, for example, ran the schools in Ireland. And here's an echo of the US and its policies toward Native Americans. Irish became banned in most schools.
To really remove a language from a community, you have to take a particular step. You have to convince the speakers of that language that it's a burden rather than a culturally useful tool. It's only at that point that they will take the extraordinary step of not speaking their native language to their own children. Any language that is eliminated, that's the crucial step that has to be taken in a single generation. A generation has to come to believe that their language is such a burden that they will not pass that burden on to their own children.
There were reasons to learn English. The potato famine of the 1840s, the Great Famine, it had wiped out 1 million Irish people, most of them from beyond the Pale, the West, where Irish was widely spoken. Another million, they fled the country in search of better lives. With it being so likely that their children would migrate to English-speaking countries, Britain, the US, Canada, places like that, it made sense that they learn English. But still, Irish families weren't just acquiring English. They were turning their backs on Irish.
Learning English does not entail necessarily abandoning the first language. Most people in the world have always been multilingual. The vast majority of human beings are multilingual, have always been multilingual. But that means in turn to persuade parents that they will hide their own language from their children, you have to work within the community. And so you need leaders within the community who will cooperate in that project.
It turned out to be hugely successful. Before the famine, 3 to 4 million people spoke Irish as their first language. A few decades later, fewer than a million did. Irish was falling off a cliff. Cue the Gaelic revival of the late 19th century. This was a movement to bring back the native language and culture. It soon got taken up by political revolutionaries, people who wanted to push the English out of Ireland. And so the Irish language became the symbol, not just of the nation, but of nationhood and independence. In 1916, almost exactly 100 years ago, Irish revolutionaries staged an uprising in Dublin, the Easter Rising. It failed in the short term. Most of the leaders were captured and killed. But it soon led to the end of British rule in all but the 6 counties that today constitute Northern Ireland. By 1922, the Irish were pretty much running their own affairs. Which brings us back to my dad, in a schoolroom, learning the recently liberated language in this newly liberated land.
So, Dad, tell me the words that you know in Irish.
I know how to count to 9. Ein, do, 3, cahar, cuig, sé, seacht, hoc, né. That is 1 to 9. And then also I remember this little request. On will Cadagom Dolamark Marche de Holly.
What does that mean?
It means, please, miss, may I leave the room.
Nice. But that's it. More than 10 years of studying the language. Some people have fared better with Irish. UC Santa Cruz's Jim McCloskey, for one, he grew up in a city a ways away from the Irish speaking areas, greatly shrunken Irish speaking areas by the time he was at school in the 1960s. But Jim's father wanted him to speak Irish, so he sent him to those areas for weeks at a time to learn the language.
Initially, I hated this experience. It was uncomfortable. It was agricultural. I was a middle-class urban child of the 60s. But gradually over the years, the place and the community and all that it had sort of cast a spell on me. And by the time I was 17 or 18, it became a sort of teenage utopia for me, representing a kind of freedom and a kind of cultural richness. Because when you actually get into those communities, those Irish-speaking communities, you find this wealth of cultural resources, songs and music and stories, and it's an astonishingly still vibrant and culturally exciting community to be even peripherally a part of.
What kind of people were you staying with? What would be the jobs that they would do, and who would be the other people in the communities who you would meet?
This was part of a larger scheme set up by the government, one of the few successful strategies they had, which was urban kids like me could go to Irish-speaking areas in the summer, stay with local families in their farmhouses, attend classes during the day and various, you know, dances and musical events in the evening for roughly 3 weeks every summer. And for some people like me, that experience turned them into good second language speakers of Irish. It was a strange situation because the people we stayed with were extraordinarily poor. You know, they were subsistence farmers or they were agricultural laborers. They had virtually nothing. So I remember being 20 boys from various cities staying in this tiny, tiny farmhouse, three-room farmhouse. And at a certain point, I began to wonder where the man of the house, Mickey Chenye Lubuil, who was a wonderful storyteller, where he slept and his brother John slept. And one day I noticed that they were going out to the barn, the outhouse, and that's where they slept in the summer to make room for us language learners. And the man I stayed with was a very eminent, very well-known storyteller. And he would tell stories after dinner in this house, which I enjoyed at the time. But it was only later when I went to university and studied Celtic studies and archaeology and so on that I came to realize that the stories that he was telling and the characters that figured in those stories could be traced all the way back to pre-Roman Gaul, told and retold and retold and perfected over generations of oral transmission. So it was an extraordinary experience to be exposed to this ancient and rich culture in that time.
Okay, so I got to say right now that Jim and everyone else in this podcast, they're pretty dedicated to Irish. Well, with the exception of my dad. Everyone else has made a pretty big effort, but they're not in the majority. Most Irish people may be proud of the language, but they don't speak it, except for a few words. Here's another believer in the language, a generation younger than Jim. His name is Iarla O'Halloran, and he had a huge advantage in picking up the language.
Both my parents, they made a very deliberate decision that we were going to speak Irish in the home.
Iarla grew up in the west of Ireland, not in an Irish-speaking region, but very close to one. For him and his sister, speaking Irish at home and English at school, it worked for a while. But then something a bit unexpected started happening.
My sister was speaking a mix of Irish and English in the same sentence, and nobody could understand what she was saying.
So they switched to English at home, too. Still, there was hope. There was school. It was the early 1990s. And there were still those Irish language classes every day, just like my dad had. Did they help? Not really.
The focus of the Irish classes was not really on using it as a speaking language. It was on grammar, it was on language structure, and it was also on Irish language culture. So we were studying Irish, but we were studying Irish literature as well, rather than studying it as a speaking language. And I think that's why a lot of my generation developed a resentment for the language.
So what was going on? Irish schools couldn't get it together to teach the national language?
I think it was a determination to not quite indoctrinate us, but to teach us as much as we could possibly be thought about Irish culture. There was an ideological aspect to it.
What was the ideology?
I think it was maybe that kind of 1930s Ireland, we will do everything ourselves, a little bit isolationist.
It doesn't seem as though the curriculum had changed all that much since my dad's days, more than 50 years before. Hiele's Irish hadn't improved at school. But something in him also resisted the resentment that so many others felt. After high school, he went to college in Galway City, which is very close to the Irish-speaking region of Connemara. And he discovered that there, you could speak the language and talk about, well, contemporary stuff. He started hanging out in Galway's Irish-speaking club,
where they had the cheapest pints of Guinness in the city, and just sitting in there and listening to people speak Irish. You know, it was an expectation that you would speak Irish. It was just I had greater exposure to Irish speakers of my own age, and so I had a greater chance to use it in a more natural, flowing, conversational manner.
Okay, so you then became fluent?
Not quite fluent. I would say that I had a pretty good use of the language, certainly a lot better than I do now. I was surprised by how much of it was actually kind of stored within me, you know, how much of it came out when I wasn't nervous to speak it, where, you know, in a school environment, you're focused on getting it right, not expressing yourself, right? So when I lived in Galway, the only requirement was to have a bit of fun, and it was really, there were expressions that I picked up from people who moved into Galway from Connemara that I found hilarious.
I know it's almost impossible to translate humour, but I would still like to ask you, what were some of those expressions that you found hilarious?
They're all sexual, for a start, right? So hearing my housemate, who was from Carna in Connemara, come in and say, "Oh, vi meje bula kraken," which is, we were having sex, when talking about his night out, or just hearing how the lads from Connemara would describe when they would see like a good looking woman on the street, how they would describe it, and I'd kind of be very hesitant to even repeat those things because they could be borderline offensive. But it was hearing laddish banter, osquelga, as we would say, that made me realise that the language could be a bit more than I thought it was.
Hiele mentioned that not speaking the language as much these days. He lives in Boston now. He's been based in the US on and off for 10 years.
One of the first things I did when I moved to Boston was I found an Irish speakers club, and they do exist. A good friend of mine from my hometown teaches Irish in Boston. So I would say that there's, even now in Boston, there's a stronger Irish speaking community than there was 5 or 6 years ago, and it's more youth focused.
And here's something Irish really has going for it. The support of the diaspora, the Irish abroad. And of course, it's especially strong here in the US, where people who call themselves Irish, maybe Irish-born like Hiele, or maybe a generation or two or five or six removed. Only a fraction of them learn Irish, but still.
And my name is Kilsian.
Yeah,
I'm Tashi Gamay. Yeah, I'm Tashi Gamay.
No, I don't know what those two people are saying either. But they are speaking Irish.
Hello, it's Misha Connell, and that means, hi, my name's Connell.
10-year-old Connell Barber. His father's called Galt.
I was born in Glendale, California. My father also was born in California. I think his grandfather, though, was born in Wyoming or something like that.
Galt came to the language through traditional Irish music, which father and son play together. Okay, yes, we're talking about a tiny number of people like the Barber family, but it shows how much goodwill there is here in the US for all things Irish. There's also academic support. There are dozens of places here, be they colleges or language clubs or what have you, where you can learn Irish. At UC Santa Cruz, where Jim McCloskey is a linguistics professor, well, there's also a research project focused on Irish pronunciation, which, if you've ever attempted it, well, you know that you can use any help that you could get. This is where Jay Padgett comes in.
Talking, it's like this amazing orchestration of different things happening in order to produce speech. And so if you want to study that, you have to see it.
See it. See pronunciation. In this case, see how Irish speakers produce consonants. Irish consonants are categorized as either slender or broad.
When I say bio, that's a slender B, and when I say bo, that's a broad B.
To see the gymnastics involved in producing these sounds, Jay hooks speakers up to a helmet-like head vise. It's kind of creepy.
So this thing looks like something from one of the Saw movies. When we whip it out, this is the scariest moments in our research.
The helmet is equipped with a camera. Hey presto, the researchers get ultrasound images of people emitting sounds. They're working with a linguistics professor in Ireland at University College Dublin. Her name?
Moira Nichasson.
Boy, am I glad she introduced herself.
No, it's challenging for non-Irish speakers here even. At times it takes a little bit of training, you know, to if there are sounds that you're not used to pronouncing.
The research itself could be invaluable, and not just to students and teachers of Irish. It's a snapshot of the language today.
We want the data that we collect to be usable as a kind of a benchmark, really. So how's the language changing?
How the language is changing. Or from another perspective, how it should change. Or maybe even should not. There's a whole lot of should when it comes to Irish. Should the language expand to include the version of Irish that some younger Dubliners speak? People far from the Irish-speaking regions. These are people who grew up speaking English, but to a greater or lesser extent have embraced Irish on their terms. It's their own Irish, one that ignores classic pronunciation or certain aspects of the grammar, an Irish that sometimes mixes in some English words. Should the language allow for that or stay pure, keeping that nation-building flame alight? It's fraught. Ireland has suffered so many betrayals over the years. Who may be doing the betraying now? Again, there are echoes of Native American languages and their struggles. And this is why there are language purists in Ireland, some in powerful positions overseeing policy. Don't mess with the language, is the subtext of their message. It defines us as a people. We brought it back after we won independence in 1922. You may not like the way we taught it and dressed it up in a narrative about what it is to be Irish. You may call the effort a failure because you didn't remember the words you learnt at school. But it gave you a sense of being, of home. Still, living languages change. That's what they do. And if they don't, it's a good indication they're dying. According to the most recent census in 2011, 77,000 people in Ireland speak Irish on a daily basis, not counting students who only speak it at school. 77,000. So it's not going to disappear tomorrow. But that same census also found 119,000 people in Ireland speak Polish on a daily basis. So what's the way forward for Irish?
There's another context in which one might look at this whole effort, and that is in the context of the global issue of language loss and the loss of linguistic diversity.
We're back with Jim McCloskey of UC Santa Cruz.
And in that larger context, in a fundamentally sort of anti-nationalist perspective on the issue, it doesn't matter much that this new language doesn't much resemble traditional Irish at all. The fact is it's a new linguistic variety. It is being used for interesting creative purposes and interesting community purposes. And it is thereby increasing the store of linguistic and cultural diversity in the world. And if your goal in quote-unquote preserving Irish is to increase the store of linguistic and cultural diversity in the world today, then one has to say that this has been a partial success. Because that community of second language speakers would not have existed if that project had not been initiated in 1922. Fáin a fhíu gwaim na hiha Cáil a rígh nach mi an hart Dán a sám cáil dair am scéil Ach tá mér malachar. There are songs, like this one, sung in Irish, with an obvious youth appeal. The video of this song, I'll post it at pri.org/language. It features students, lots of them, at one of those summer camps in an Irish-speaking region. So leg my seer on some fire, spawn and blow her a scarecrow. On a make can't scream a lot, she might get trouble falling. So leg my seer.
The last frame of the video has a four-word message. I won't even try to pronounce it. You could translate it into English as, check these out. Jim McCloskey says it's one of those new phrases from urban Irish, the type of new Irish that makes traditionalists squirm. Well, that's it for today. Besides this video, there's a bunch of stuff at our website, like a photo of that helmet-like clasp and an ultrasound image it produced of Irish pronunciation. That's at pri.org/language. Additional reporting this week by Doug McKnight of KAZU, public radio station. A big thanks to Doug. Also, thanks for the really big response to our name tag series. That is, the stories behind place names. We got so many suggestions, like, what's the story of a road called Zizix Road? That's in the Mojave Desert in California. Or why does Maine have a whole bunch of towns named after countries like Mexico and Sweden and Peru and Denmark and others? We've started to dig into a few of these questions. More answers will come in future episodes. If you have a name tag story that you'd like us to investigate, a question about a town name or a street name or a building name, any place name, let us know at the World in Words Facebook page or on Twitter at LingoPod, or drop us a line. The address is language@pri.org. Guess the Accent of the NEH Funder is back. It's coming up again in a minute. Let us know if you think you know where the speaker comes from. Bonus points if you can guess the region as well as the country, and how long she's lived in the United States. My dad gets the last word on Irish. I asked him, was it ultimately a good thing that he studied it all those years?
It was a good thing, and it was quite fun, but I wasn't scholarly enough really to appreciate that. I don't really feel now it did any harm. At the time, of course, the opposite opinion would have been held by me. I would have said, no, this is a terrible waste of time because you don't need this language. And the occasional Irish teacher would say, you'll regret it one day that you didn't work harder, you know. And I actually do. I really would like to know it much better than I do, and I don't know it at all. It's all gone.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI. Oh.